I do invite you to go with me again to the book of Ecclesiastes and to the 9th chapter as we are drawing near to the end of our study. We still have a few more weeks to go and some huge weeks that I'm really looking forward to. We're going to study this morning. We're going to start in chapter 9 and verse 13. We're going to go all the way through the 10th chapter. And there's really a question that's still before us this morning that's from last week that still continues to be before us as we pick up our study, and it is this: how should we live in light of the fact that time and chance happens to all? How should we live in light of the fact that time and chance happens to all? That's the question we began to answer last week. We've got to make sure we understand the question. By time, the preacher meant all the evil, all the difficult things which take place over time and in the midst of time. By chance, the preacher didn't mean random chance, but he meant unexpected events that are out of our control. Whereas we learned last week, the race isn't always to the swift. The battle isn't always to the strong. The bread isn't always to the wise. The riches aren't always to the intelligent. Favor is not always to those with knowledge. In the situation where, as we've been looking really for a number of weeks, we've been confronted with the fact where we're limited. We can't figure out all that God is doing. We can't understand all of the times. We're very often finding ourselves in situations where the unrighteous and the ungodly are oppressing the righteous and the good, where there's things that are not as they should be in this life. Well, the first thing that the preacher commended to God's people, as we saw last week, was actually joy and enjoyment. Joy that comes from knowing God. Enjoyment of all the good things that God has given us. Where we saw that incredible exhortation when he said, "Go, eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already approved what you do. Let your garments always be white. Let not oil be lacking on your head. Enjoy life with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life that he has given you. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might." That encouragement of joy and enjoyment. Enjoy those things. Because even though unexpected events comes to us and we all are going to experience one day, we were given this reassurance: the righteous and the wise and their deeds are in the hand of God. And because they're in the hand of God, we're in the hand of God. The Lord's ruling over our lives. The Lord is at work, even though we can't always understand it. Enjoy Him. Enjoy what He's given us. Trust in Him. And so that's the first thing that we were commended in response to that question. How should we live? With joy. Enjoying what God has given us. Well, this morning we're going to see that the preacher also commends to us wisdom. And that may seem surprising to you because we've been going through how many chapters and how many weeks now where we've been learning really wisdom. It's all about wisdom, isn't it? It's all about wisdom. It's from the wisest person who had ever lived, Solomon himself, and it was from the Lord himself. The Lord, the God of heaven and earth, has given us wisdom. Well, by wisdom, though, coming back to this, the preacher means earthly wisdom or wisdom under the sun. Yes, that ultimately comes from God too. But earlier in the book, the preacher had exposed the vanity of earthly wisdom apart from knowing God. But here he commends to us still the relative value of wisdom, especially in comparison to folly. And he's coming back to us again, continue to be wise. And what's interesting is when he commended joy and enjoyment in the last chapter, it was very emphatic. In fact, it was the sixth time that he had commended joy. But it's so much more emphatic, and it was so much more detailed. It was with that word, go, get on with it. Go enjoy. Go live with joy in your heart because of and enjoy these things. Well, interestingly, when he commends wisdom, as we're going to see in just a moment, we're going to see that he does it in response to an example of wisdom that he had seen, that he describes as a great example of wisdom. It was a powerful example of wisdom that he had noticed, and one that he wanted to realize, and that he, in a sense, he springboarded off of, and to encourage us to be wise. And from that example, and the conclusion he makes about wisdom, the preacher then launches into a series of proverbs of wisdom and its superiority to folly. We're going to begin by simply reading the example, and then a little bit later in the message, we'll go one by one and read each of these proverbs and talk about them for just a moment. But notice, first of all, the example of wisdom that he saw as we begin our reading in verse 13. He says, I have also seen this example of wisdom under the sun, and it seemed great to me. There was a little city with few men in it, and a great king came against it and besieged it, building great siege works against it. But there was found in it a poor wise man, and he by his wisdom delivered the city. Yet no one remembered that poor man. But I say that wisdom is better than might, though the poor man's wisdom is despised and his words are not heard. The words of the wise heard in quiet are better than the shouting of a ruler among fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. This is God's word to us today. Well, that's just a very brief and very simple explanation or example of wisdom. Notice that this example of wisdom, though, was witnessed by the preacher, and it took place in a little city. A little city that was marked by the fact that it had few men in it. Which means if there were few men, there were very few people to protect it. There were very few soldiers to guard it and to defend it. And so a great king came with his army and besieged it, building great siege works against it. And if you know anything about the old ancient battle, what would they do? There would be walls around the city. If someone wanted to come and take the city, what would they often do? They would take dirt, or they would take all types of things, and they would take logs or trees, and they would build them up so that they could get to the height of the wall, and then they could scale the wall of the city and take the city. Well, that's what was happening to this little city with very few men in it. But there was someone in that city. There was a man who was described simply as this, a poor wise man, but what was he able to do? By his wisdom, he delivered the city. Now, very interestingly, we're not told who the king was. We're not told anything about the city. And as you can imagine, there's been all kinds of speculation down through the ages. What situation was Solomon talking about? What had exactly in history had he witnessed? Well, we're not told. We're also not told what plan he came up with so that he was able to deliver the city. Many people have seen a lot of parallels between this short description and something that's told in 2 Samuel. Maybe the story that Solomon knew through his father, King David. Because in David's life, there was an interesting example that took place. There was an example of a wise woman who saved the city of Abel in the days of King David, when it was being besieged by David's commander, Joab. The woman had the wisdom to call out to Joab as he's beginning to besiege the city and simply ask, "Why are you besieging the city?" What was she told? Well, she was told that there was a man named Sheba who was in the city, who had lifted up his hand against David, and he was on the run from David. That's why they were besieging the city. And so interestingly, the woman went through the city, talked to all the people, they got together, grabbed Sheba, executed Sheba, cut off Sheba's head, threw Sheba's head over the wall, and Joab quit besieging the city, and everyone was saved because this woman was wise. That's a pretty wild story, isn't it? But she had the wisdom to ask. She had the wisdom to go do something about it, and the city was saved. Well, if we go back to this example that Solomon, the preacher, has seen, again, we're not told the details. We are actually told that the poor man was soon forgotten. What he did wasn't remembered. But even despite that, the preacher, Solomon, came to several major truths. He realized several major truths that jumped out to him from this example. And the first major truth was this: wisdom is better than might. Wisdom's better than might. In fact, even if the poor man's wisdom would have been despised and no one would have listened to him, it didn't change the fact that wisdom and understanding is still better than power and might. That's something to think about. Wisdom is better. Because again, so often, what are we prone, very tempted, to consider better, to actually pursue power and might rather than wisdom? This is interestingly illustrated even further by the difference of a wise person's words being heard in private versus the shouting of a ruler among fools. A ruler may be able to get the people to follow him by being louder and more convincing, but a wise person whose words may only be heard by a few are still better. They're still better. They'll prove to be better in the long term, will they not? Even if the vast majority of people will not listen. And yet, what's the temptation? The temptation is to go with the crowd. The temptation is to go with the one who's speaking the loudest and seems the most convincing at the time. The temptation is to put your finger up and lick your finger and go, "What's the latest poll say? And I'm going to go by the latest poll of the people." Is that wise? No, it's not wise. But that's the temptation. That's what's constantly put before us. Interestingly, if we think about it, the words of the wise that many oftentimes are only spoken and heard in quiet, those words speak for themselves if we will only listen. If we will only listen. And oh, how we need to listen. Because the enemy, there is a great enemy. The enemy desires to deceive us. The enemy desires to destroy us. Oh, how we need protection. Oh, how we need deliverance. Oh, how we need wisdom in our day. Do you sense that? There's so many voices clamoring. There's a lot of shouting. There's a lot of insults being thrown all over the place. There's not a lot of wisdom in various situations that's taken place. And so the preacher, he continues to come to these conclusions. And notice what he also says: wisdom, therefore, is better than weapons of war. Wisdom is better than weapons of war. But here's the warning. Did you see the warning? But one sinner destroys much good. One sinner can destroy so much good because of his sin and because of his folly. Well, to illustrate all of this, the preacher then launches into a series of proverbs which demonstrate the kind of wisdom this poor wise man had, and which he's obviously commending to the people of God, to the ecclesia, as it sometimes would have been called or understood, and how wisdom is better than folly. Let's begin with verse 1, and we'll put these together in different groupings. But let's begin with verse 1 and notice the dangerous consequences of folly. It says this, "Dead flies make the perfumer's ointment give off a stench. So a little folly outweighs wisdom and honor." That probably should have been my children's lesson. I should have gotten some perfume with some dead flies in it, and that would have gotten the children's attention. Dead flies makes the perfumer's ointment give off a stench. So a little folly outweighs wisdom and honor. Well, let's first of all, what did we say folly is? Well, folly is foolishness, okay? Folly is foolishness. Folly is it's doing that which doesn't make good sense. It's doing that which is immature. It's doing that which without thinking everything through. One of the consequences, though, of folly is that it can ruin a good reputation. Notice that the preacher tells us that a little folly outweighs wisdom and honor like a dead fly can make the perfumer's ointment give off a stench. In other words, it only takes a little foolishness. It only takes a little foolishness to outweigh and therefore overcome years of acting wisely and honorably. You notice that in life? You can do a lot of things good, but you can really mess up. You can mess up one time big, and boy, it sticks with you. It sticks with you, and you can't get past it. This is probably a terrible illustration, because I don't think this person was probably living very honorably before, but I remember I was noted in the last couple of weeks that Monica Lewinsky said recently that her scandal sticks to her like peanut butter. Because you can't shake it off. She can't shake the stigma of it. People won't let her move on. And so the exhortation here is, be sensible. Be wise. Protect yourself. You think about the poor wise man. His ability maybe to be listened to was because of his reputation. And he still had a reputation. Let's go to verses 2 and 3 and notice the difference between a wise man's heart and a fool's heart. It says, "A wise man's heart inclines him to the right, but a fool's heart to the left. Even when the fool walks on the road, he lacks sense. And he says to everyone that he is a fool." So what does it mean that a wise man inclines him to the right? Well, it's simply that the inclinations of his heart are to the ways of God, to what is right, to what's good, to what's safe, what's therefore worthy of his effort and pursuit. While a foolish man's pursuit inclines him to the left, and meaning here just this, making the distinction between right and wrong, to that which is wrong, to that that's not good for him or others. One of the descriptions of a fool, as we were saying to the children, is it's of a person who lacks sense. And by his very actions and attitudes, he tells others that he's a fool. It's obvious to other people, even when he doesn't realize it. But why is that? What are some particulars that might stand out? Well, listen to some descriptions of a fool from Psalms and Proverbs, where Solomon writes about this a lot in Proverbs. It's even mentioned in Psalms. Psalm 14, verse 1 says this, "The fool says in his heart," anybody finish it? "There is no God." That's what the fool says. There is no God. You don't need to worry about God. There is no God. This is all there is. Proverbs 10:23, "Doing wrong is like a joke to a fool, but wisdom is pleasure to a man of understanding." It's a joke. No big deal. Proverbs 14:8, "The wisdom of the prudent is to discern his way, but the folly of fools is deceiving." Meaning a fool is a deceiver. He's a liar. He's a cheat. Proverbs 14:9, Fools mock at the guilt offering, but the upright enjoy acceptance. I don't need a guilt offering. I don't need someone to make me clean and presentable to the Lord. Proverbs 15:21, folly is a joy to him who lacks sense, but a man of understanding walks straight ahead. A fool loves, he finds delight in that which doesn't make sense. And then one more, Proverbs 18 verse 2 says, a fool takes no pleasure in understanding, but only in expressing his opinion. He didn't want you to understand what you think. He doesn't want to understand. He just wants you to know what he thinks and what he believes. Huge difference. Well, let's go forward. Because next we see in verse 4 how to handle a disapproving ruler or authority figure. And it says this, if the anger of the ruler rises against you, do not leave your place, for calmness will lay great offenses to rest. This may refer back to the story of the poor wise man we don't know. But what's the advice? Don't leave your position or your post, even though the ruler, the position and authority over you, is displeased with you. Don't leave it. And it may be in this situation that it's don't leave your position of influence or your position to potentially influence. He's saying instead, you've got a disapproving ruler or authority, calmness. Calmness and not retaliation many times will lay great offenses to rest. It'll calm the situation. It'll calm the and enable you to diffuse his anger, and then, of course, for you to be used in the future. That's something a lot of times we're struggling with, a lot of anger and a lot of responses to anger. And Christians right now are being tempted to respond, and a lot of times are responding to certain things inappropriately. Let's go forward to next. We see the uncovering of many a ruler's error. Look what it says in verses 5 through 7. It says, there is an evil that I have seen under the sun, as it were, an error proceeding from the ruler. Folly is set in many high places, and the rich sit in a low place. I have seen slaves on horses and princes walking on the ground like slaves. So what's many a ruler's error? The error is they put someone who is foolish and therefore full of folly in a position of power and an authority. While the person who's really worthy of an elevated status and position is sat in a low place. When he says folly is set in many high places and the rich set in a low place, notice that he's not putting to opposites the poor and the rich. When he says rich there, he means someone who's rich legitimately. They're rich in character. They're rich in ability. They should be in that position. They're qualified. Does that make sense? And so what's happened is someone who's not qualified, someone who's foolish, is put in this exalted position, while the person who's qualified, who's got character, who shows himself, is put in a low position. The same thing as you see the illustration of having seen slaves on horses and princes walking on the ground like slaves. When he's mentioning slaves, he's not mentioning someone who's been kidnapped and put into slavery. He's more likely talking about someone who's a slave because they sold themselves into slavery, because they're indebted, because they have no other means to survive, because they've acted foolishly. And yet they're the ones in charge, while the person who really is the nobility, they have the position to be there and should be there, is not leading. What's interesting about this illustration is this is actually the type of folly that was demonstrated by none other than Solomon's son, Rehoboam. He came to power, he came to authority, and what did he do? Instead of following the advice of Solomon, his father's wise counselors, who were associated with his father, and who counseled him to deal with the people gently, and how to handle the people, what did he do? He chose to surround himself with young leaders like himself, young men who were foolish, young men who told him to even be harder and to be this basically tyrant to the people. And what happened? The kingdom was divided. The kingdom of Israel was never to be the same. And so we see that even as Solomon gave this wisdom, his son, his own son, did not listen to it. Let's go forward to verses 8 and 10 where we see how wisdom brings success. It says, "He who digs a pit will fall into it, and a serpent will bite him who breaks through a wall. He who quarries stones is hurt by them, and he who splits logs is endangered by them. If the iron is blunt and one does not sharpen the edge, he must use more strength. But wisdom helps one to succeed." Notice what's happening here. The preacher is mentioning several dangers which come with folly. There's the danger of falling into a pit that you've dug for yourself. You ever done that? That's pretty humiliating, isn't it? You ever set a trap for yourself and you didn't realize you set a trap for yourself? But it ended up being a trap. The danger of being bitten by a snake when breaking through a wall. The danger of being hurt by falling stones when quarrying them. The danger of being hurt when splitting wood. Why does he mention several these dangers come with folly? All because you don't think ahead and consider the danger. You dig a hole, but you don't consider that you made a hole for yourself. You begin to split stones, split wood, but you haven't put on protective eyewear to save yourself from that danger. But what do we know about wisdom? Wisdom is said here to bring success. Why? Because it makes us take caution. It gives us a discernment and an ability to sense danger ahead of time. It makes us take the time to do the things that will make for greater efficiency, like sharpening the axe and not hacking away all day on a piece of wood because we won't stop long enough to sharpen the axe so that then it'll chop the wood and we can be done and we can go on and do something else more beneficial with our time. Now, I got to be honest. I tried to tie all this back to the wise poor man and I was going, well, I see the wisdom here. I don't exactly see how it all ties back, but somehow I'm sure it does. Let's go forward. Notice in verses 11 through 15, or really I should have said the last one was verse 11. It should have been 8 through 11. Let's pick up with verse 12. This is the difference between a wise man's words and a foolish man's words. It says, "The words of a wise man's mouth win him favor, but the lips of a fool consume him. The beginning of the words of his mouth is foolishness, and the end of his talk is evil madness. A fool multiplies words, though no man knows what is to be, and who can tell him what will be after him. The toil of a fool wearies him, for he does not know the way to the city." So what is characteristic of a wise man's words? It's very simply put, his words are gracious. They win in favor because they're gracious. Are our words gracious? Are they full of grace? Are they full of undeserved favor? Even how we speak, how we address others, how we speak of groups. What is characteristic of a foolish man's words? Ooh. They consume him, or you get the idea, they destroy him. Because he says they're foolish from the start, when he starts talking, and they're evil madness by the time he finishes. What do you think evil madness is? Boy, they're out of control. Y'all know what madness means. It's crazy by the time he gets to the end of his speaking. He starts out talking foolishly. By the time he's done, he's so out of control. And even though he doesn't know what the future holds, it says he multiplies his words as if he knows so much more than he really does. And then it says he wearies himself out and others with all his talk, even though he couldn't tell you how to get to the city. He couldn't tell you how to go. He couldn't tell you how to get down the street to the next town. And yet he wants you to listen to him and think that he's wise. Pretty harsh, isn't it? Description of the fool. A couple more. Y'all hang with me. If we go to verses 16 through 19, the difference between a blessed land and a cursed land. It says, "Woe to you, O land, when your king is a child and your princes feast in the morning. Happy are you, O land, when your king is the son of the nobility and your princes feast at the proper time for strength and not for drunkenness. Through sloth the roof sinks in, and through indolence the house leaks. Bread is made for laughter, and wine gladdens life, and money answers everything." This is a hard one in different ways, but obviously very clearly, what land is cursed? A land where the child is a king. What's the child? Who's a child? Someone that's obviously very immature. Someone who's unqualified to lead, who doesn't have experiences, who has impulses like a child. And of course, sometimes children have been put as kings, haven't they? Not too many of them have done very well. But he said, a land is cursed where a child is king. Princes feast in the morning and to get drunk. But what is a land that is blessed? A land where the king is the son of nobles and the rulers feast at the proper time and for the right reasons. What it means here exactly about money answers everything, I'm not exactly sure. Some have thought money is to the cursed, to the foolish, money's thought to be the answer to everything. Then other people have described it as those who are wise, though, they have money because of their hard work to pay for everything. Let's go to one last one in verse 20. How not to speak about those with power and authority. It says, "Even in your thoughts, do not curse the king, nor in your bedroom curse the rich. For a bird of the air will carry your voice, or some winged creature tell the matter." How are we not to speak? We're not to curse the king or the powerful rich. In our thoughts, nor when we think, we're not going to be heard by anyone else. Obviously, why not? Maybe this is where the little birdie illustration came from. You know, sometimes I say to y'all, well, a bird told me that something's going on in your life. Well, this is the idea of a bird, except the bird takes it and your words get out. It gets back to somebody in power. It gets back and has consequences. And so you see in this that he's commending not only joy and enjoyment, he's commending wisdom in the midst of, yes, time and chance happen to us all, unexpected events, difficult things, difficult people being in power. And here's an interesting question for us. Are we wise or are we foolish? Are we really acting as someone who's wise, or if we're really honest with what ways are we acting foolishly? You know, going through that list, I got to admit, there's things that jumped out at me. I said, well, I've acted foolishly there. A lot of times it's with my thoughts or my speech and the ways that I want to react to different people in authority or something of that matter. But I think even more important for us to see is to obviously see that wisdom, we need wisdom, but ultimate wisdom, it comes from God. It comes from knowing Him. It comes from knowing Jesus Christ. One of the things that's interesting to me is what you could say about Jesus that is very much like the man who saved the city. When Jesus was on this earth, was he poor or was he rich? He was poor. Was he thought much of or thought little of? He was thought very little of. And yet he was infinitely wise. And by his wisdom, he saved, in a sense, the city of fallen man who's been besieged by the devil himself. And he saved it through what seemed foolish at the time, and yet proved to be wise for salvation. He saved the city by dying in our place and then rising again. As we're going to read in just a few moments before we have the Lord's Supper, he became for us wisdom and righteousness from God. Wisdom and righteousness from God. Two of the most important things that we need. We need wisdom from God. We need his righteousness. So think about it like this. Giving our lives to him, it's the wisest decision we can ever make. Because he's overcome the enemy. He secured the terms for peace with God. He shows us how wisdom is true strength. He shows us what is better than folly. He shows us the truth. And if you think about all of these things, obviously truth and wisdom always lead to life. They always lead to blessing. They always ultimately lead to peace and to deliverance. So think on these things, pray in response to them. But be on the lookout for folly, for the foolishness that surrounds us. Don't be deceived. Don't be drawn in. Stay in the Word. Stay under the influence of the Word. And as we're going to really be challenged in James for our 50 days of prayer, what does it tell us to do? If anyone lacks wisdom, let him ask of God. We need more wisdom. So let's be about the business of asking him. And he tells us and he encourages us in the book of James, ask with faith, believing, and he will give us wisdom. Because what was happening to the people of God that James was writing to? It was the Jews who were dispersed. Why were they dispersed? Because of persecution. Because of suffering. What were they told? In the midst of their trials, have joy. Ah. Joy in the midst sounds like Ecclesiastes. Go, be joyful in joy. Because God is even working through your trials to produce perseverance and steadfastness and faith. So if you need wisdom, ask of it. Ask of it, God for it, and he'll give it abundantly. Let's do that. Lord, we do.